British politics looks like it's moving fast into a new phase. Is this a turning point, a moment that campaigners can seize to finally move things in our direction? And if so, how do we do it?
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, facing huge political pressure.
I want to apologise.
There were real mistakes made.
The person who is in charge of the ship is regarded as a serial dissembler, as an habitual liar.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. On today's podcast, we're joined by Seema Saeeda, a new staff member in the Another Europe office, to talk about our campaigning priorities for the year ahead. How do we make this a moment of change? And with so many authoritarian aspects to this government's agenda, how do we build the links and tell an interconnected story? We'll be giving you the lowdown on what Another Europe's plans are and why you should join.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then, but that's why we need to keep going because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
Seema, great to have you on the pod for the first time. You've joined the Another Europe is Possible staff team. When did you start? Who did you kick off to get there? And how has it been going?
Hey, thank you so much for inviting me onto this podcast. I joined the staff team in September, but actually it feels like I've been with Another Europe for a lot longer. So I was on the National Committee for a couple of years. And before that, I was out on the streets on all the anti-Brexit marches, helping to organise the Stop the Coup marches and being at every demo and sort of shouting my head off. So I'm sure a lot of you who are listening to this podcast might have heard me before.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking I've already met you, so you're definitely not new to me, AEIP-wise. Maybe it's just a formality that you've now been employed.
Where did Michael go?
Didn't he go to Chile?
Yeah, I think he's touring Latin America at the moment.
But Luke, can you clear something up for me? Did he actually ensure the socialist revolution in Chile, or was he just did he just happen to be there at the time it happened?
I don't know where you heard that there was a socialist revolution in Chile, but... It might be over-egging it a bit, but I think he has certainly been talking to a lot of people out there and writing stuff about it. I think you can find, listeners can find stuff that he's written about it for Navarro, actually.
Maybe we'll put the links in at the end of our pod, or maybe we won't.
A democratic leftist upsurge is probably closer to the mark.
And sorry, Seema, to get back to you, you've been really busy this week, right? There's been the big demonstration in Parliament Square. Tell us what the protest was.
So this Saturday, there was a big Kill the Bill mobilisation. Another Europe actually organised a different protest outside the Home Office against the Nationality and Borders Bill. But Kill the Bill, who are mobilising against the very authoritarian policing bill, got in touch with us and said, let's combine our forces. So we did that and we had a massive mobilisation marching from Lincoln's Inn to Parliament Square. We held a huge rally. There were some great speakers and the energy was really brilliant. And off the back of that, there's going to be another protest tonight called the Very Annoying Demo. And I'll be speaking at that as well. So we'll be joining the forces against the policing bill and the borders bill. So it's been very, very busy, but very, very fun. And you can definitely pick up some Another Europe placards at some of these demos. So do come along.
It did seem worrying, I thought, from a distance, that all the mobilisation against the policing bill, which is amazingly authoritarian and draconian, and a lot of which is spearheaded by Best for Britain, wasn't really linked up with the immigration bill, even though, certainly from where I'm sitting, they seem as bad as each other and coming from the same place. But Luke, was it basically all the same people, you'd expect on both marches?
There's a few groups, Another Europe is Possible, and quite a few people in the Remain family are concerned that we need to do more joined up thinking around. There's actually four bills that are really of concern, but I think the most concerning are the policing bill, as you mentioned, which is a really authoritarian attack on the right to protest, the nationality and borders bill, possibly the most extreme of the lot, really, because it criminalises asylum seekers and refugees, and it is almost completely in contradiction to international humanitarian law, super racist and authoritarian piece of legislation. So there's a real pattern in across those four bills of very, very authoritarian legislation. And I think it's been really exciting to see the street mobilisation around the policing bill, where activists have come together to challenge it. And that's been going on for about just under a year now, but it's been pretty sustained protests. I think Saturday's day of action wasn't just in London, but it was all over the country. So there's been a real upsurge in post-pandemic activism. But it's just really important that we draw the links with all of these other pieces of legislation, because the issues aren't really political. Everyone who's going along to the policing demonstrations and protests are going to be in sympathy and support with refugee and migrant rights. And as you say, there's lots of campaigning going on at the parliamentary level, like, as you mentioned, Zoe, to try to get amendments through to these pieces of legislation to make them slightly less awful. And I think one of the challenges were, how do we make all of this visible and present them as part of the same thing? And hopefully the corruption scandals give something of an opportunity to present them as very joined up, because corruption and this crony capitalism and the one rule for us, another rule for everyone else politics of Boris Johnson, I mean, that is completely bound up with their authoritarian agenda. It's two sides of the same coin. And I think the challenge is to make that visible and real to people, I guess.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add, I think these bills are very much the kind of actions that Another Europe sort of foresaw happening, as built in as part of the far-right Brexit project. The attacks on civil liberties, the attacks on migrants, it's just a huge ramping up. So I feel like our organisation is still very much relevant and needed in raising these issues and fighting them and resisting them.
I feel more like the whole edifice is crumbling now than I've felt for ages. You know, there were times in like the 2010 to 2015 when people were really angry and people were really suffering, but the kind of government and the machinery seemed absolutely robust. Whereas now I feel like they could be, it feels much more febrile, and even more febrile than during the kind of terrible May Brexit negotiations. But am I just being overly optimistic, or do you have that sense as well?
Well, I think you specifically have a boy who cries wolf problem, Zoe, because you always think the edifice is crumbling.
Yeah, but...
but I suppose that doesn't mean that you're wrong in this instance. The edifice might well be crumbling.
Yeah, and it also feels like things that... I feel like the kind of morass of political commentary among people who don't really care about politics is that they don't want to sound stupid. And for ages and ages, it sounded stupid to say, oh, you know, maybe this government is corrupt, maybe this government is authoritarian, maybe this is a massive, massive kind of heist by property developers and hedge fund managers who've somehow managed to capture the Conservative Party and take it in a very right-wing direction. All those things sounded really insane 2 years ago, even though I believed them. But now it feels like that's quite a normal point of view.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, personally, I could kind of see what was going on, and I felt like it was very real, everything you've just described. Maybe I'm just a bit more foolish and a bit more bold, because I was saying a lot of those things earlier. And yeah, you're right, people did think, oh, that's a bit too much. It's not as bad as people are saying it is. But it is as bad as people are saying it is. And I do think it's febrile, and I do think it's crumbling, but I think the onus is on us to take that space and organise and mobilise to bring down government too. So we do have agency. It's not something we're observing. It's something that we can actually shape and change.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, if we can talk about this as something that is coming to an end, hopefully. I don't know if that's really optimistic thing to say, but if it's true that we're now in the end game of this very, very authoritarian Tory Brexit project, I think one of the lessons for us and for people like observing the UK internationally is a simple one, and that is that authoritarianism can be popular. I mean, you know, we often assume or sometimes people assume that authoritarianism is just counterposed to democracy. And if you're authoritarian, you know, you can't put forward a kind of majoritarian or democratic argument or anything like that. And you've really seen how treating those two things as counterposed, you know, having a majority of some description and being authoritarian, that's the wrong way to think about it. And, you know, unfortunately, Brexit provided a way in for very, very right-wing politics, more right-wing than Margaret Thatcher in many respects, much more draconian and authoritarian and much more racist in its border policy. And so that created the coalition, but corruption, in a way, has undermined that electoral coalition. And if there's a lesson internationally, it's that we have to really emphasise those crony capitalist elements, that this is an out-of-touch elite. It's not the will of the people. It's not genuinely democratic in order to break up these authoritarian electoral coalitions.
This kind of segues quite nicely, Luke, into the question of Brexit. You know, it's happened. Everybody has accepted it's happened. Everybody's accepted that there are going to be ramifications which are going to be really negative, but we just somehow have to swallow it. Why are we still talking about it? And why? And what is the Brexit Spotlight Project?
Yeah, so I think we've been, you know, thinking about for a while, and we're not the only ones. Well, look, you know, Brexit has happened, so, you know, what do we do now? And as Seema said earlier, all of the things in a way that we warned about are still happening. So we have to keep going. We have to keep campaigning around these issues and pointing out the problems. And so we think that one of the experiences or lessons of Brexit is that we need better scrutiny and we need better information. And so we created the website Brexit Spotlight in order to pick apart the Brexit process as it's happening. And it has a whole series of different thematic areas, from citizenship and migration to jobs and the economy, and particularly manufacturing has been a theme. We're also looking at agriculture, which is a big change area as a result of Brexit. So there's all of these different, very multidimensional areas of policy that are changing as Brexit is happening. And we thought that we really need a place you can go to, brexitspotlight.org, where you can get analyses on the ways in which these are changing, and also what the problem is from a progressive and left perspective. What would we do differently going forward? And so the site is an opportunity to have that discussion. We're also running an event series called the Brexit Spotlight 60-Minute Briefings. We have another one coming up on the 7th of February about the government's review of the Human Rights Act, which is really worrying that the Human Rights Act is going to be watered down with new legislation. This has been something that the Conservatives have been talking about for a long time, but they might now actually be doing it. So it's really worrying. And we've got Francesca Klug speaking at that event. She's actually one of the architects of the Human Rights Act back in the 1990s. So, and she's great. So she's going to be talking about why it was invented and what benefits it's brought. So that's going to be a really great event to get expert informed analysis of what these changes mean. But it's part of a series, so we're doing lots of different stuff like that and to build a better informed movement. And I think one of the things you've seen around the borders bill, actually, that we were talking about earlier, is that there's just so much happening. It's almost like really difficult to keep on top of it, even when you're a really informed activist, even when you read The Guardian every day, like many people do, no doubt many of our listeners do. It's really hard to keep on top of it. So having that good quality information and analysis, a place you can go to get the briefings you need from that progressive perspective, is really important, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you just made such a convincing case that I thought I might actually read this.
We need better informed Guardian journalists.
Always. That's what you always need. So, you know, there's a kind of existential crisis for everybody. And I, you know, not just Another Europe Is Possible, but all organizations which obviously feel the need to kind of scrutinize and oppose as Brexit moves forward, but also might just feel the kind of catastrophic hopelessness now that it's happened. Seema, where do you kind of see the pressure points, the points at which you could make it be less bad, the points at which you could muster the energy of people who never wanted to do it in the first place? Where do you see that kind of playing out?
I think there were lots of key milestones. So when all of the labour shortages happened and we had the petrol crisis, it was very, very clear that Brexit was one of the major causes of that. And when people see it impacting their daily lives on such a massive scale, I think that's those are points where we can mobilise and change the narrative. Also, I think when we had all those deaths in the Channel recently, which was really heartbreaking, there was this mass public outpouring of sympathy and empathy. And while I think our messaging should strongly be that no one is illegal and migrants are always welcome for whatever reason, this conjuncture of huge labour shortages and then refugees dying in the Channel and these attacks on migrants, that completely showed the irrationality of the government's agenda, where we need lots more people coming into this country and we welcome them to run the country. But at the same time, our government is literally creating policies that result in them dying in the Channel.
And do you think that's the kind of the best next iteration of the movement, rather than kind of moving on as a pro-migrant, pro-freedom of movement, pro-refugee gathering, so that you kind of slightly shift the focus, so that you kind of get away from constitutional issues and abstract issues and onto people issues and empathy issues?
Exactly, like the things that practically affect everyone in their day-to-day lives. We don't necessarily need to talk about Brexit as a whole, but clearly Brexit is causing all of these massive disruptions to people's lives that And it's concrete and tangible and they can see it. So, yeah, I would agree with you that that's where we should move it to.
And Luke, what do you think about that as a... Can you foresee any problems with that? Will the kind of pro-European movement slide seamlessly into a human rights-based pro-migration movement?
So I think the movement is perhaps already in that space. I suppose that the challenge has always been making that space bigger and bringing more and more people in. I think you have to do, I mean, for my part, I would say you have to do you both. So you need to put forward the humanitarian, human rights, internationalist case for open migration systems. And then you also have to say, well, look, you know, we as a country have a whole series of different things we need to do. We have an increasingly elderly population. We need migrants to come here to work. We've got 1.3 million job vacancies at the moment, the highest since records began in 1999. So I would hope, if I'm being optimistic, there is a space for a movement that's pressuring all of the parties and but is also reaching out beyond its comfort zone to say, well, look, this is both an internationalist position that's against borders, and it's a pragmatic position, because for all of the problems that we face in the 21st century, they're basically collective action problems. We need to work together with other countries, whether that's climate change, whether that's conflict and war, whether that's vaccine apartheid. These are things that all need and require international cooperation to deal with them. So there's got to be a space for a movement that is values-based and internationalist, and also actually putting forward practical things that'll work. That'll be the hope. That's what I hope Another Europe is doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I feel like, in a way, what went wrong with the kind of Remain campaign before the referendum was lost was that we didn't make that we didn't, the constellation, it didn't look like a constellation. It looked like a kind of bag of kind of different agendas, that the kind of things lefties think. And now it feels like there's something much more coherent going on underneath and much more mappable. It feels more like a left-wing Dominic Cummings has done it than a left-wing Boris Johnson has done it, if you see what I mean.
Hopefully, yeah. I think the question, the problem that Remain as a whole always had from 2016 and afterwards was it couldn't answer the question, what kind of country do you want to live in? I think that was the big problem. So, or if it did, it often sounded like, well, the country we want to live in is the country that we were living in 2015. Can we go backwards, please? And that was just hopeless. That's useless. And although, of course, that was never another Europe's position, you know, I think the movement as a whole was pretty open to that criticism made by its critics, right, on the left. But I think they were probably right about that, if we're honest. I would hope now there's, because in a way, you know, Brexit has happened, good or for good or bad, and in a way that forces everyone to be more, like, practical and pragmatic and put forward that vision. So it's no coincidence that a lot of the other different Remain organisations are now emphasising democracy, electoral reform, etc. And that's because they see that as necessary. You know, I agree with them on that. You know, changing our democracy, fixing the British constitution, that's clearly an essential part of what we need to do. But I think they're at least starting to answer a bit the question of how does Britain need to change.
So, Seema, you did it. Another Europe did an event, which listeners can see on YouTube, about Islamophobia. Again, the links we're talking about here. Well, could you flesh out those links between what's going on in the Islamophobia far right terrain and what's happened in the past 5 years and what the plans are for taking that forward?
Sure. So, as someone who comes from a Muslim background, watching Nigel Farage's Leave propaganda, looking at that Breaking Point poster way back in the run-up to the referendum, the Islamophobia was really clear. You could see that they were mobilising a deep sort of vitriolic hatred of the brown, usually Muslim other. The migrants that were pictured in all of these posters were often people from Middle Eastern background and often men as well. And they created this entire very nationalistic sort of orientalist fear of a threat and an invasion of a male dominated other that was kind of threatening the integrity of the nation. And Islamophobia is very much sort of subtly linked in all of that. So while I was on the committee of Another Europe, I was really keen to see the organisation take a strong stance on that and start some campaigning. And we've also got Shaista Aziz, who did the Three Hijabis campaign to kick racism out of football. So together, we're trying to come together and build a broader campaign, engaging lots of community stakeholders led by the Muslim community to raise awareness of what Islamophobia is, how it manifests itself, and how it's being mobilised by the far right for their xenophobic, nationalist, anti-migrant project of borders, not just in the UK, but across Europe. So we're hoping to build an international campaign.
Yeah, well, I think this is an area which is perfect for Another Europe, really, because, you know, we're not just a UK-based campaign. We're also mobilising and working with European alternatives across borders, across Europe. And naturally, unfortunately, it goes without saying that Islamophobia is something that is sweeping Europe, has swept Europe over the last two decades and extends well beyond the far right, although it's obviously a critical part of what the far right are doing and arguing. And it's an issue where European Union border policy itself is I'm afraid, very Islamophobic and often, I think, I'm afraid, very, very racist. I would give you the example of what's happening on the Polish border or what has been happening over the last 6 months or so, where we've seen those horrible scenes of Iraqis, Kurds, I think some Syrians too, but very small numbers. You're talking like less than 10,000 people. I think one estimate I saw was 8,000 most attempts at illegal crossings from Belarus into Poland. And so you have a European Union and a Polish government, far-right government, Law and Justice, but I'm afraid the European Union as a whole has emphatically backed their policy. Now, if you consider that Poland has taken 50,000 Belarusian refugees, far in excess of the number of illegal crossings attempted by Iraqis and Kurds, etc., over the last year, if you think on top of this, Poland itself has a huge migrant population with vast numbers of non-EU citizens living in Poland. The biggest migrant group is Ukrainians. I'm afraid it's impossible not to draw the conclusion that European border policy is heavily, heavily Islamophobic and racialized. Because if you're from a majority white country, there are very normal, safe, legal channels for you to enter the Schengen area. And if you're from a Muslim country, the policy over the last 10 years, with some very notable exceptions, notably Germany, of course, it's not all the same, but the policy has been basically to keep you out, regardless of whether you've fled war, political repression, and violence. Now, that's a straight-up racist policy that needs to be called out. And I think this Islamophobia campaign that Seema and Shyster in particular are working on is a really important opportunity to put the another in another Europe.
Yeah, I mean, just I have two really quick follow-up questions to either of you. Firstly, thinking of Paul Mason's book, How to Stop Fascism, and actually also your book, Luke, Authoritarian Contagion, it does seem as though Islamophobia and white replacement theory is really the kind of connective tissue which makes a lot of far-right thinking make sense. And it strikes me that the way to, that the kind of first point of entry into this argument is to try to get the center right, or the normal right, if you like, to pull away from what is actually quite a dangerous kind of fascist underpinning. And it's hard to say how to kind of bring that home to them, because they hate words like fascist. And secondly, to what extent is this an American export? Because, you know, that all the kind of media generation of Islamophobia was explicitly funded by the Koch brothers over the early noughties. And I feel kind of ashamed and disgusted by the way we've sort of, you know, the rest of the OECD has sort of embraced what is an American brain fever in a way that we never did, for example, McCarthyism.
I just want to pick up on your point about the centre-right and the right. I think it's not just the centre-right and the right that we need to work on. We also need to work on the labour movement and the left. And this is something that all of the panellists who were invited to our Islamophobia event raised. Because even in the Labour Party, I remember I was in Limehouse and Poplar, and my MP used to be Jim Fitzpatrick. And he was talking about how the whole constituency had been taken over by Sharia law and things like that, which was completely alienating to the majority of Bangladeshi Muslim people there. And there was no uproar. He faced no repercussions for that. He retired of his own accord. And Zara Sultana, Absana Begum, they've been talking about the huge amounts of Islamophobia that they face. So I think the left needs to start standing up to Islamophobia, and then we can then take that to the right as well.
Yeah. That's a very good point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the challenge that you raised, Zoe, about the centre-right and far-right, I mean, I suppose it goes back to what I said earlier. Unfortunately, it takes quite brave centre-right politicians, and that's the reason why we haven't seen enough of it to really speak out against this, because unfortunately it's often very popular with their core supporters, and in many countries they're losing votes to far-right parties. And so the Social Democrats, of course, you know, the cliche in Germany, but also elsewhere here in the UK, the cliche has always been, oh, it's Labour losing votes to UKIP, or UKIP voters are ex-Labour voters, or AfD voters in Germany are ex-Social Democratic voters. I mean, that's never really been borne out by the data. It's always been, of course, they get some votes in that direction, but they get plenty, about twice as many, from former centre-right parties. On the other hand, I think, you know, we're hopeful in this project we can talk about the bad cases and some of the good cases. I think there's, and we want to build more links with Germany in particular, because Germany has taken all of these Muslim refugees from Syria, and there are so many good stories about integration. I mean, if you look at a city like Cologne, for example, which you and listeners might remember was the site of really horrible sexist attacks on a New Year's Eve a few years ago, which was very heavily instrumentalized by the far right. But the city hasn't accepted that. I mean, it's pushed back against it, saying that we're against attacks on women, but we're not going to racialize this issue, and we're going to build popular civic integration from below. And in the last elections, lots of the biggest cohort of Muslim MPs, or MPs from a Muslim background, has entered the German Parliament. So, you know, there's lots of good news stories here about what we can do when we resist Islamophobia, as well as the bad stories that we all are, of course, very familiar with.
Yeah, sorry, Seema, I was also agreeing wholeheartedly with your point about the left and Islamophobia, except I had myself on mute, so you won't have heard that.
Yeah, I've just actually seen that Eric Zemmour has been found guilty of inciting racial hatred. So the far-right French candidate who's deeply Islamophobic. And it's quite interesting that the establishment in France is making these moves to censure this kind of rising xenophobia and hatred. But at the same time, again, I think we can see that there is space for civil society, the left, the labour movement to mobilise and change the cultural space and attack these issues on Islamophobia.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what other international plans are afoot?
Well, we, over the last week or so, have been entering into chats and discussions with activists in Ukraine and Russia. I mean, as listeners will know, really, really, really troubling situation on the Ukrainian border at the moment, where there's a huge build-up of Russian forces and the threat. Hopefully it won't happen. Hopefully it's just a spectacle, but the threat of a full-scale conventional invasion of a European country. So, you know, this is a time when we absolutely need an international anti-war movement saying we're not going to accept this. We need international peace and dialogue. And I think this is an area where another Europe has to sort of put a flag in the sand and build more international links. I think there is there's something akin to war fatigue, unfortunately, in many countries in Europe and the global north. You know, we've just grown extremely used to violent conflicts taking place in and around the European continent. And I suppose what we want to say is that we can't normalise this as something that we're used to. We have to have an international social movement response. And the first step has to be building links between Ukrainians, Russians, Northern Europeans, people from the Middle East, you know, as broad as you can make of people from Turkey. You know, Turkey's obviously had some really nasty conflicts on the Syrian border as well. So this is an international problem, and we've got to do something about it.
The way you say that makes me feel quite optimistic, but, you know, that's my way.
Yeah, I think even your optimism on this question will be tested.
Well, I mean, the weird thing is, you know, you talk about building international links, and it's organisationally a lot of heavy lifting. And I feel like the pandemic kind of interrupted not just our practical ability to get out and about and to other countries and to other kind of, and to kind of convene, but it sort of attacked us all at the level of the psyche. So we stopped thinking, we kind of got an internal border and stopped thinking about connections with other countries. But is that, do you feel like that?
A little bit, yeah. I think we need to create more forums for debate and discussion so that we can break out of our national confines, yeah.
And do you feel like post-pandemic, because of the kind of leaps and bounds in our understanding of remote conversation, that we'll be able to, you know, are we looking to an age when we're going to have a lot of public Zoom meetings going spanning Europe? Or do you think we're going to all want to get back into the same rooms together?
Yeah, I think, well, I think we're probably going to do both, aren't we?
Yeah. Seema, this is the question you were born to answer. How can listeners and AEIP members get involved? What can we all of us do?
I'm really eager to meet people in real life. And I have actually had the opportunity to go to Palermo with European Alternatives, to go to Brussels to see the European Left Conference. And I do feel a difference at these places at the moment. People have so much more urgency and so much more of a desire to organise than they had before the pandemic, in my view. And I think people see that we're in this international great conjuncture of history, maybe because of this global phenomenon that we've all experienced, that we can only solve with international solutions. So I'm quite optimistic for internationalist organizing.
Okay, good. Excellent. And what can a listener do today? What can a listener do tomorrow? What should we all be focusing on?
Well, there are lots of different ways to get involved with Another Europe. You can participate in our digital campaigns that we run when we do letter writing campaigns to MPs and online petitions. That's one really quick, really easy way that everyone can get involved. Watch out for that in your inboxes with more stuff around the Nationality and Borders Bill in particular. There's also our online event, Seema.
Yeah, so we're hoping to run an event on border abolition. We're going to get some great speakers who've written on the topic, activists in the Mediterranean who are actively giving material solidarity to migrants. So that's going to be coming up soon. There'll definitely be more on Islamophobia. There'll be more on Russia and Ukraine. There'll be something on the rise of the far right in Italy and France. So we do hope to sort of accelerate and boost our internationalist links. So do come and join the events, the in-person actions, the online actions as well.
Yeah, and we also, I don't think we've got one lined up at the moment, but in not so long ago, we did a National Day of Action around the Nationality and Borders Bill. So that's when you can take action of either a small or big character in your local area with other activists, also doing in real life stuff as well.
That sounds great.
Well, it's been great to talk to you both.
Yeah, you too. I mean, I feel quite optimistic and I feel like I should be making an AEIP, a bespoke AEIP to-do list, which will start with logging onto Brexit Spotlight every day, Luke, I promise.